We've got Roman Mars coming up now. He does a show that's called 99% Invisible. And judging by his headshot here, he is 99% invisible as well. We just see a beard, and a nicely trimmed beard at that. I must say he's on the phone with us now from Berkeley, Roman Mars. With us. Hey, Roman, are you there?
I am.
How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Fine. Does the Mars clan originate out there on the West Coast or elsewhere?
We kind of moved around a lot. I think I guess I claim Ohio as our home.
You do? You claim it?
Yeah, exactly.
Is it true or you just claim it?
Well, I mean, I spent there the longest growing up. But my sister and I now move. We live across the street from each other in Berkeley, California now.
So. Well, how cool. How cool. Yeah. And it says here, Roman Mars makes radio. So I've been trying to do that now, too. I'm trying to relook at the way I do radio. I just do it, you know. But you do make it because you do. It's yours is extremely well produced. And we've never done that here. I have a producer, but it's just window dressing. He's dressing in the window right now. You can see him. Tell us about 99% Invisible. Where'd you get the idea for it?
Well, it's a radio program about architecture and design, and it sort of started locally here on San Francisco Public Radio Station, KALW, and a full project of the AIA, the American Institute of Architects in San Francisco. Yeah. And it started as this idea to tell the background story of buildings and the built world here in the Bay Area, but it expanded kind of quickly to include the rest of the world and all kinds of design detail.
Yeah. Are you an architect yourself or in design?
Not at all.
No?
I'm really been a radio producer for the longest, it's been for the past 13 years or so. And it just was a beat that was interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of this is made possible through Kickstarter. Is that true?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I started just going and sort of not getting paid all that much to do it, and it started to gain a bit of an audience, and I was trying to figure out how to pay everybody and keep doing the show. And so we, in the third season, we turned to Kickstarter and did really well, and then we did it again.
Oh, cool. That's a great idea, making the audience pay.
Yeah, I agree.
Here we got to wait for, donations and things like that. They cough up quite a bit of money just to keep your show on there. That's the way it should be, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's really just I learned the technique from doing pledge drives on public radio. It's really not all that different. Why the amount of people giving to the entire world, and Kickstarter is a really compelling platform for people to give because you have this threshold effect that you don't get any of the money unless you get all the money that you need.
Oh, I see, yeah.
So it really psychologically kind of flips a switch in people, and it becomes like a little game. And so we did really well with it.
Yeah. And what you do is really unique, I think. The best beer in the world. That was like the Trappist beers. You're looking for Trappist beers? And
right. You would take sort of any sort of built world, like human-made thing, and put a design lens on. Mm-hmm. And so in that case, I was really interested in this. Is the reporter, Bruce Barabar, was out there, and he loves beer. And we like to go around and have an excuse to visit Trappist beer places. And I was just really interested in the idea that they didn't have any sort of customer service to speak of, but they had this most popular beer. And I like to sort of think about what goes in behind each decision.
Mm-hmm. And what is it with Trappist monks making beer? I mean, is there something in the Bible that allows that? Or?
Well, it's kind of, they have a sort of edict that they have to be self-sufficient, so they make beer to support their monastery. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of, there's several of them do ales and beers, and some do lentil soup. But their whole idea is that they're self-sufficient and it serves their purpose to be closer to God.
And you can bet there's some beer in that lentil broth. There's no way there isn't. Yeah, and Christian Brothers, they got that they've done really well for themselves out there, so. It's the same sort of thing, I guess. And then I like this thing we do, the sounds of the artificial world, and this thing on the, we have a little clip here, if you don't mind us playing it, from the accidental music of imperfect escalators, which I really think is a cool idea. Explain a minute the thinking behind that.
The accidental music, the idea of the improvised escalators is there was a jazz critic or a music critic at the Washington Post named Chris Richards, who began to classify all the creaking, skronking escalators in the D.C. metro system as different forms of jazz. And it was kind of just a way of coping with the fact that these things are horribly broken and neglected. But they sort of gave people a little bit of joy once he began to think of them in this way.
And as a musician, he could appreciate exactly what they were doing musically.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
That's cool. Can we play that clip right now? This is from that.
It sounds like music.
And like any good music critic, Chris started classifying the different styles of metro escalator. So here at Farragut North, the escalators might sound like
whales mating or something like that.
Whereas the escalator at U Street
kind of sounded like Indian drone music.
And at Columbia Heights,
an aviary of chrome-throated ravens taunting you as you descend into your workday. It sounds...
So that would drive you nuts, yet there's a deep beauty to it.
Well, that's the idea.
Yeah.
Normally it would, but it's once you sort of recast it and understand the story and maybe the joy it can bring you, mm-hmm. People engage with it in a different way. In fact, the one of the escalators, the whale moaning escalator, somebody put up a fake plaque that said, "Please enjoy our our escalator, which is tuned to whale song to make your day a little bit better." And there's a way that sort of the people were just engaged with it in a different way. And I kind of like the way people interact with the built world and how they can control of it.
And is that part of your thinking, too, in terms of design? It's also the unintended consequences of design. That interesting?
Yeah, absolutely. That's like that's hugely important to me. The intended consequences. In fact, the best design is often invisible to people.
Mm-hmm.
And so sort of highlighting it, recognizing the genius and things is a nice way to look at the world.
Yeah. Well, as far as the sounds of the artificial world, what other sounds have you captured in this quest? Artificial sounds.
I mean, strangely, I don't do a ton about sound necessarily. Yeah. I mainly do the stories of buildings, but I do like the sounds of the artificial world. Sometimes I had somebody talking about the sound of the unlocking of an iPhone, which has a real great kind of click and a spring. It has a real mechanical feel to it, and it's just one of the things that makes this kind of pretty inert piece of glass and metal feel like a mechanical object.
Mm-hmm.
And these are really compelling things to us psychologically, but we just don't really notice how they're working most of the time.
Yeah, I like this also. This one on Samuel Plimsoll.
Yeah,
he's the man responsible for that circle with a line through it on the hulls of ships.
Yeah, that was really meaningful to me too, because it's a very simple idea, the circle with a line through it. But and I think it's beautiful in its own in a little design way. Mm-hmm. But it's also really important in terms of just how many lives it saved when the sort of merchant seamen were being, actually just the lives weren't really regarded very well because insurance would make it so that it was sort of profitable to sink your ship and overload them. And so he, instituted some laws to make it so that you had to have this Plimsoll line displayed so that people couldn't leave port with an overloaded ship.
So that's what that line tells you. If it's over that, if it's covered, then it's overloaded?
Yes, exactly.
Ah, Plimsoll. And did you learn a lot about the man himself, Plimsoll?
Not especially. I mean, I know that despite of his, he was really, really, he was really moved by a particular ship sinking and wrote a lot, wrote a large tract called Barra Seaman. And it was all about the plight of the merchant seaman. And he was just a really dedicated MP.
The Arsenal of Exclusion. Tell us about that one. That's interesting.
These are about the the sort of things that were built into the environment to divide populations. So they're
to divide populations.
Yeah. So like there's like bollards on streets. Like if you live in especially in Baltimore where this story took place, there's a group there that was sort of cataloging all these different ways in which the community was divided, black and white, rich and poor. Some of them are large streets that are these arterial streets that make it so that they don't have a lot of crosswalk. So, like, a whole section will be in these grid light structures, which have a lot of pass-throughs, and a lot of them have more curvilinear streets, which are kind of harder to find out if you jump you out into the pass by the whole neighborhood. So there's all sorts of ways that the built environment has been made to sort of cluster people and have people not be, you know, find their way in, get lost when they get in, or get shunted out if they ever make it in there.
Yeah. And this is all intentional to keep rich neighborhoods separate from poorer neighborhoods and so forth.
Absolutely intentional. And the legacy of that of those choices sort of continues today, even when parts of them break down a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Isn't Baltimore where they paint their window screens too?
I don't know.
I'm pretty sure it's. Isn't anyone here from Baltimore? They actually put paintings on their window screens for some reason. Okay. Never mind that. It's probably not true. So there's so much stuff. And do people come to you with ideas? I bet they do know about design ideas. Totally.
Yeah. No, I get emails every single day about something interesting or cool in their life that they want me to do a story about. Often I find it perplexing because they want to explore a thing they already know all about. Mm-hmm. I think it's comforting about somebody doing a story that you already
Hello?
That's it.
His battery finally went. I think we were speaking of design problem. Roman Mars, ladies and gentlemen. Oh. 99% invisible, 100% invisible presently. Okay, did we lose him entirely? Was that the battery that was going the whole time?
I'm here.
Oh, you're still there? You're cutting out a lot on us, and so I don't know if it's your. Can you hang your head out the window or something? Are you still there? Okay. What?
Can you hear me now?
Much better. Let's start it all over again. Roman Mars has a show called 99% Invisible. I think we're still having problems with that. Your own love of design, or just an interest in design, you never pursued that as a career, however.
No, I was really just, I'm interested in radio and telling interesting stories on the radio. And this is a good thing to talk about.
Yeah. And was Ira Glass an inspiration for you as far as doing that, the style of doing it and so forth?
Oh, sure. I mean, he sort of changed the game for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I got into radio actually because I listened to a ton of it, and one of my favorite shows was Popular Nation when Ray Suarez was on.
Sure.
And there was this episode back when Bill Clinton was president with this quaint little subject of who is the hero if, you know, the president isn't a hero.
Yeah.
And I was excited for Monica Lewinsky, so everyone was upset with president. And somebody called in and said, you know what, Ray Suarez, you're my hero. And I was listening at work, and I was like, you know what, Ray Suarez is my hero, too. And I just sort of made it my mission to work in public radio after that.
Well, I know I've drawn a lot of people into the field as well. A lot of Michael Feldman wannabes out there. Actually, I don't think I have one yet so far. I had a kid years ago, and we did What Do You Know? We did a kid version of What Do You Know, and there was a kid who was just done very well at his bar mitzvah, doing the speech and the mofter and all that stuff, and thought he could do my job. But it's not quite the same thing as being drawn into radio by Feldman-esque sort of thing. Tell us about the 99% invisible. What does that mean?
The idea of the name was I was trying to think of something in design that unified, you know, architects, product designers, graphic designers, and the thing that was this idea that the process of design is mainly invisible. Even when the object is this giant thing, the most of the work that went into it and the design thought is 99% invisible.
So you don't, the thought behind it is not there, but it's intrinsic though, right?
Like, it's intrinsic. I mean, the whole story, the whole thing about it, like if you look at any object, it's only 1% of what it really is. It's all the thought that goes into it.
Yeah. So that's true of a pyramid or an airport or anything else that you look at.
Exactly. Yeah.
Doorknobs and latches, that sort
yeah.
of thing. Those things always annoyed me because they're never thought out properly.
Yeah, well, the thing is about design is that you notice a really bad one,
yeah.
and you don't notice the really good ones, and that's on purpose. And so a lot of what I think of as my job is to do stories where you do notice the good one.
Oh, okay, all right.
Yeah,
but I got a lot to say about door latches, but I guess I'll hold off on that. I just think push or pull should be universal. I think it should make a law, and it should be enforced that doors are, you either push them to get in or you pull them to get in, but not either one, because then you look like a fool too often in your life.
But they should be designed well so that they feel intuitive.
Yeah.
There's nothing worse than a pull latch where you have to push. That's really bad.
Yeah. But what's more intuitive, to push a door to go through it or to pull a door?
I don't really know.
Push? Okay, there it is. Push doors. From now on,
okay.
No pull doors.
He'll never get out of anywhere.
But you have to pull it from the other side.
Oh.
That's
a good point, too. I guess when entering, I'm thinking about here. This thing on check cashing stores was funny.
Yeah. Well, I was
and not so funny.
Idea.
Yeah.
This reporter, Doug Gray, who I know here locally, he did this story about check cashing stores. And what I was most interested in was the ideas of what made check cashing stores work. Like for a lot of us who are used to banks, check cashing stores seem weird because they kind of are modeled more after a corner store or a bodega. They have linoleum floors. They have bright lighting. They have these, menu of options.
Yeah, so you've been in them is what you're saying.
Yeah, sure. But you're kind of, they're sort of meant for a different thing. And there's something about a bank that even though if you've been raised to go to banks, they're used to them. But if you haven't been and really been engaged in the sort of financial world, they're very, very confusing. There's no menu of options. There's no, you have to ask someone what you want. They're pretty intimidating. And there's some things about check cashing stores, even on the surface, they don't work for a lot of people who are used to bank. They really work well for the audience they're trying to serve. They're trying to serve people who are coming off of work, who are mistrustful of banks because they've done some hidden fee thing that cost them something at some point. And even though the fees are often exorbitant and, they're probably not ideal, they're upfront and clear. And they have a menu of options, and they are printed right on the wall. And so I was really interested in that idea of what you could learn from these things and what was actually sort of confusing and upsetting about a regular bank for a lot of people.
So the implication would be to make a bank more like a check cashing store?
I think that you could make different types of banks, and you could make them more clear. You could put up a menu of options, and you had to sort of navigate this booklet of what the fees are and how it's all going to work.
Yeah, yeah. Do you ever look at Apple stores and why they work like they do? That's kind of a...
I never have really. I mean, one of the things that I like to focus on is not the sort of pretty and glossy thing.
Yeah.
And those are definitely the prettiest and glossiest thing.
Yeah.
I have to admit, I find Apple stores kind of perplexing, even though I tend to buy a lot of stuff from them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I like going to a counter. I feel weird walking up to a person and buying something from them who's like free floating in the store.
I find the whole genius thing a little upsetting.
just going up to someone and
the whole genius, the genius guy, or the genius bar on the, to me it was always a pejorative. So what do you think, genius? So it has a counter. It's counterproductive to call anything genius like that. So you'd rather go to a check cashing store than an Apple store, is what you say?
Well, I think there's some degree of comfort with a Tarkovsky story. At least you know who you have to go to, which is the counter with the person standing behind it. Maybe behind bulletproof glass, but still, you know where to go. Whereas I don't want to have necessarily a social interaction every time I go to a store. And it's actually like you're going up to a stranger when you have to buy something at the Apple store. At least the one around here, there's a person that you just buy from who's floating around the store. And I'll find that very odd.
Yeah. And Costco, there's another one.
At Costco, I can't handle.
No. I don't belong. They threw me out last time. I walked in. I had some time before I had a medical exam. So I walked into the Costco and they said, "Hi, can I help you?" And I said, "No, I'm just, do you have your Costco?" I didn't know you had to belong even to come go to a Costco, you know. So it's a whole different thing, you know. And they said, "Well, you can look around, but you can't buy anything." That's an unusual story right there, you know. Right on the, so that'd be worth examining, I think. Roman, I want to thank you for your time. The show is the big hit right now on public radio, 99% Invisible, and I want to thank you for taking the time.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Nice talking to you. Roman Myers from Berkeley. 99% Invisible. Okay. All righty. Okay, there then. Well, then. Okay. What?
I didn't say
that. What are you thinking?
Oh, no, I was thinking about that check cashing store.
Yeah.
Because I used to go to one of those when I first moved to Chicago. Didn't have a bank, and you go in. But they do charge, like, I don't know, 2 or 3%.
Do they?
But they take your driver's license, and then you can always go there and cash your paycheck.
Very nice.
Yeah. Exciting.
Good story.
Yeah, isn't it, though?
Why don't you send that in to him? Maybe he can use that next time they do that.
Nice.
That's good. How are you, then? Pretty good?
Yeah, how are you? You pretty good?
Yeah, it was pretty cold down there in Chicago, I bet.
It's very cold and a lot of snow, yeah.
That Zephyr, and then you got the lake effect.
Oh,
and,
boy, yeah.
And then the vortex.
Snow effect. Yeah, the vortex.
You got the vortex, Zephyr, and the lake.
That's a triple threat right
there.
Oh,
my God, yeah. That's the end of the world.
It's a triple horseman.
Yeah. Was it even worse? How cold did it get down by you?
I think, well, I don't know about the wind chill. I think one night it was just 18 below, maybe 16
that's
below.
That's not bad.
Yeah, no, it's not bad.
Because you got the warm lake water.
I thought it was pretty bad.
No, we had 21 on my thermometer.
Yeah, 21.
Anyone
below?
Beat 21?
Minus.
Yeah, just yell it out. What is it? What do you got?
Negative
23.
23? Yeah.
Negative 23. Beat that?
27.
27. Going at 27. What's 27? Where was your 27? Where were you?
Wisconsin Rapids.
Anyone beat that? 27?
Yeah.
That's the nation's icebox. Wisconsin Rapids.
Well, you know it's cold when
rock,
the dogs just—they don't want to stop and sniff other dogs' pee. They just want to like boom, boom,
yeah.
boom. Let's walk around the block a couple times. Okay, we're on our way home now. Let's go. Let's go.
My Puggle was like that. It was like a dragon. I mean, she was trotting. She never does that. I was pulling me through the damn pine. Yeah. It's icy and stuff, and I'm trying to stay on my feet. And this thing, this little thing, is pulling me. You know, and there's snowbanks. People can't even see that I have a dog. You know. So they think there's some strange, crazy man toppling down.
Is that Feldman again? Oh, he's weird.
Yeah, it's so embarrassing. Now. I did.
Some
I got
kind
her
of a neurological disease or something. Like,
yeah. It's covered though under Obamacare.
Yeah,
so I feel pretty good about that. But I got her a little sweater though.
Did you? Oh yeah.
Very nice. Do you have sweaters for your dog?
No. Somebody gave me a down thing one time, and I said I can't do this to my dog.
Yeah.
The other dogs will laugh.
Oh yeah, they're okay though. They're pretty.
Yeah, they're labs, so they like it.
Okay, that's cool. All right, now here you got another song that you wrote.
It is another song that I
wrote.
Holy
cow!
Jeez,
holy
cow!
You're on a roll here.
Yeah.
You should get that. What do they call that? That money for nothing from people.
Huh? How do you sign up for that?
Yeah, you know, like you get what do they call that? Quick starter stuff.
Oh yeah, quick start. Yeah.
They could pay you to stop writing songs.
No, that's a government program.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, yeah, they can lie fallow. Song is lying fallow.
Yeah, songs lying fallow. Oh, that's the next album.
And this one here, tell us how this one came about.
I don't really remember. I've modified it a number of times. So.
Okay.
And I still don't have a title for it, so it'll be
you don't?
Called Song Number 3.
Okay, because then you got to copyright it.
Yeah.
Or something.
It's copyrighted.
Even though it is just for the doing of it. Okay. And Jeff Hammond on the bass.
listening to Michael Feldman's What Do You Know from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI Public Radio International. Very nice.